This is the Genuine Humans podcast, brought to you by Social Element. I'm Tamara Littleton.
And I'm Wendy Christie.
In our podcast, we'll discover the stories of the leaders behind the brands and the trailblazers who are making a real difference in our industry. We'll delve into how they got to where they are today.
And we'll hear about the genuine humans who supported and influenced them along the way.
Welcome back to Genuine Human Podcast. And I'm here with my fabulous co-host, Wendy Christie.
She knows. I love it when she calls me fabulous.
How are you doing, Wendy? How's your weekend been?
It's kind of been filled with babysitting. So it's been full on and I'm feeling very happy to be at work. How are you?
Well, I had a great trip. I went to Dublin and I think I got the last of the summer in Dublin and it was fabulous. And karaoke may have been involved.
Good. Keeping the side up there.
So I'm delighted to welcome today another fabulous Genuine Humans guest, and that is Richard Levy, and he's joining us today. Richard is the founder and CEO of Sephera Marketing, having previously been Brandside, leading high-performing teams globally for companies such as GE, Santander, First National and MoneyGram. So welcome to the podcast, Richard.
Thank you both. It's lovely to be here. So thank you for the invite. Very excited.
So, Richard, I know that you sort of heard our podcast before. You know what happens at this stage.
Yeah.
We are going to ask you, how did you get to where you are now? I'd love to know more about your early career. Was there a real plan for sort of getting into marketing? Did you accidentally fall in? Just give us a little flavour of your early career.
Well, I would love to say that there was a plan that I've been following through, but that would just be totally incorrect and false. That there was no plan, and there probably still isn't much of a plan, but it happened by accident. I went to university years and years and years ago and studied business, and the good thing is that you learn all different kind of bits and pieces about the world of business. The bad thing, or not bad, but the downside, shall we say, is that you come out and there's no clear defined path for you. So I don't know if it still exists, but back in the day, there used to be what they call the milk round.
Oh, where
you apply to various, the fun of the milk, where you applied for various jobs. And they varied from people like Glaxo to Rolls-Royce to Ford to what is now Santander. And I got the role at Santander. So it's a little bit like exam practice, was that the more you did of these things, the slightly better you got. So I think I was quite lucky. Santander was near the end. And so I got on the marketing role there. I'd enjoyed marketing at university, but it would be disingenuous to say it was what I was destined for. I'd rather fell into it, and I spent about 2 years there and on the graduate scheme. It's quite interesting because I'll come back to this a little bit later, but I think there were six of us. None of us had studied marketing at all, and yet somehow you got into the marketing graduate scheme, which might raise its own questions. It might be different now. But you spent 6 months at a branch at Swiss Cottage, in my example, in North London, which I loved, really loved, because you actually learn what's really going on. 6 months then in unsecured personal loans in marketing, which was great because it was the only department at the time that owned its own P&L in marketing, so I got that P&L exposure. And then 6 months in advertising, and advertising was a lot less sophisticated then than it is now. We did the coupon codes where you had to sort of quote, I don't know, 1, 2, 3 if you dialed in, and we could measure how many people said 1, 2, 3. And so it was a great experience. Looking back, I think I was totally ill prepared for it, in as much as you move from being at university into moving into a huge company with so many facets, so many different bits to it. I think I was probably quite naive in the way I approached it. And I don't say that harshly, I say that factually, but I think it's a massive step. And then from Santander, I went to a much smaller company called First National. There were only about 60 or 70 of us, and I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed the fact it was small. Everyone did everything. There was a lot of personal responsibility. You could build up relationships. I really enjoyed that. And then we got taken over by GE, and this was the time where GE was the company to work for. GE were I mean, it sounds astonishing, but we're acquiring businesses globally once every 3 days.
Wow.
When I was there. So they were just buying companies in this very systematic manner. And GE at the time was, I think we were like, there were 300,000 employees. I don't know if we were the first or second biggest company in the world, but we were one of the two. And it was just the most incredible culture shock that you suddenly move from a company of sort of 60, maybe 70 people to a company of 300,000. And I remember they got us all in a room on the day that they made the acquisition, and they said, "We bought you for your talent. We're really excited. We've heard good things about you." And of maybe the 60 people who were in that room, I think 3 months later, there were five of us remaining.
Oh,
so
wow. Okay.
It was brutal. And the five of us remaining, it wasn't due to, I'd love to say it was due to some remarkable show of brilliance, but I think it was the fact that marketing was in London, and therefore it was just easy to sort of move me across. And I spent 6 years at GE, and the advantage is you learn how businesses are run. You learn numbers. You learn to be able to articulate yourself, elevator speeches, just questions about, if you did not know your numbers, it was just, you were sunk. And
yeah.
So marketing, I don't know, you know, when people talk about, oh, is it sort of all creative? And I'm thinking, well, it's definitely not all creative. It's about what you're adding to the bottom line and how much capital we were borrowing against what we were getting back and getting things through finance. It was an incredible education. And I still maintain this, that the people working there were the best I've ever worked with. It was like going to university every day. It was astonishingly difficult in some ways, but astonishingly rewarding. And they did have the infamous appraisal system where the bottom 10%, twice a year there was an appraisal system, and if you're in the bottom 10%, I think we used to have a saying that they went to Canada. Went to Canada meant people just disappeared. It's like, oh, where's so-and-so? Went to Canada. Okay.
We'll never talk of that again.
So it depends whether you're a believer in that competition is better than collaboration or collaboration is better than competition, because you were, in effect, in competition with all the people you were working with, because you were desperately trying to avoid falling into that sort of low echelon. And I stayed there 6 years, so I survived 12 different appraisal systems, as we would put it, and then they resold that element of the business back to Santander, oddly enough. And I, having started there, I thought it was probably a better time to move on. So I moved to MoneyGram, which is a sort of remittance-based company. And at the time, we were relatively, it was very regionally based. So the UK, where I was head of the UK. We had a lot of autonomy to make our own decisions. And again, what was interesting was how much I loved working for those smaller businesses again. We were probably in an office of, again, 60, 70 people. I knew everyone. Everyone knew me. And I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that much more than being in a bigger role where I thought, a bigger company where I thought I was in a siloed role and this is what you do.
Yeah.
You don't go out of that. And if you want to talk to someone who's managing the website, we've got to make an appointment and try and justify it to their diary keeper, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I really enjoyed being in a smaller company. Had lots of autonomy. The UK region at the time was doing really, really well. I remember sort of my first day there, they showed me these numbers and I was like, you know, there was double-digit growth going on, which if you think this is 2009, we've just come out of the global financial crisis, or that was still going on. MoneyGram was doing exceptionally well. And I sort of stayed there 10 years and I started off in the UK and then became head of Europe marketing-wise, had direct reports literally from the sort of one side, from Ireland on the one side to Russia on the other side with a number in between. And I thought that was, it's a totally different experience managing people, one, in a different country, two, who come from a totally different culture than you, and three, who you have this language issue. I remember we one of our main clients with the Italian post office, and I sat in a room with them, like, there's 10 people and there's me, and you're the only one that doesn't speak Italian, so they have to speak in English because you're the pain, right, who they have to converse with. But every time they want to say something probably about you that they don't need to hear, they quickly switch into Italian and then go, oh, sorry, come back to English now. And of course you can't say, what did you just say? But what's really interesting and what's really challenging is you go in there as head of Europe, but you're not from their country. You don't speak their language. How do you win them over? How do you make them think, actually, this guy is okay? And you really need your people on the ground to be supporters of you, to say, look, be excited, because they can make or break you. You know, if the person working for me in Italy is saying to them, that the scud doesn't really know what he's doing, that's the end of it. If she says, oh, he's really good, then you have to get the respect through them. It's really interesting managing people in different countries. And, you know, there was the Nordics and the different people group the Nordics together, but you have separate countries there with separate attitudes. And yeah, it's just, it's pretty, you know, France and the labour rules in France, which are totally different to the labour rules anywhere else in the world, right? So you have to sort of get used to that. So it was a fascinating experience, but it became very, very centralised in Dallas. So what I found was that there was continuous friction, I would argue, of a relatively unhealthy nature between the centralised Dallas team and the localised team. So I don't think in marketing it's certainly uncommon to have friction between central versus local.
Yeah.
But I do think that when there's a misalignment of goals and the region want A and centrally who I was reporting into are saying, no, we have to do it like B, it puts you in actually quite a sort of difficult position. You know, I used to go to Dallas 2 or 3 times a year to try and build relationships on both sides of the ponds, but it was a challenge by the end. We also brought in our MoneyGram, traditionally had been through third parties, post offices, Tesco, etc. And then we went direct to consumer. Really interesting channel conflict. How do you price differently when you go on your own? Who owns the customer? How to annoy all the retailers you're working with who think you just want them for yourself, right? How do you manage that relationship? Really fascinating strategic projects. And it was great. But I think once you've been there 10 and a half years, I think there is a danger that you can become a little bit institutionalized. And I do think that I've learned this. There is a natural job lunch. It might be 2 years, it might be 10 years, but there does come a time when naturally you feel my time is probably up. And then I moved to, again, smaller business, Note the Trend, called OFX, who were based in Australia, lovely Australian culture. Sort of driven but laid back at the same time, a little bit difficult to explain, but I like the Australian culture. But again, small business, went from like a team at MoneyGram of like 40 odd people to a team of one really talented individual, that person though, so loved working with her. But nevertheless, I'd been there, I don't know, 3.5-4 years, and I think again that just becomes a natural, if you're honest with yourself and the company are honest with you, you know, that there's just a natural time to move on for you and for them, and everything's very amicable and fine. But I think you just got to be a bit honest about when that time is.
And when did you get that kind of feeling inside that you wanted to actually go a different path and actually start up on your own? Because it is still a very brave decision. You know, you've been down like the corporate route. When did you get that bug?
It's a good question. I think there's 2 or 3 different factors. One is that you meet people like yourself tomorrow, right? And you get talking to people and you say to people, what have you been doing? And you see that actually there's a lot of people who have gone and gone on their own. And guess what? They're still here and they're still smiling and they're still doing podcasts or and running businesses. So they survive. So I think there's that. I think my sort of network increased quite rapidly through meeting a lot of different people. And secondly, I think when you feel you have something to offer, you know, I'd been doing this for 25 years in marketing. And I look at marketing as an industry, and there's so much good about it, like truly good. And there's so much that we're not very good at. I think, again, being really honest, and, you know, there's so much misunderstanding of what marketing is. And when you're a big company with multi-million dollar budgets, I think all is fine and all is well. But I think when you're a smaller company, small to medium-sized business who are just trying to get on their feet, and it's a bit of a sort of, you know, it's a different environment, then I really felt I could make a difference. So I don't know if that entirely sort of answers the question, but one, I felt that I met a lot of people who have done it. Two, I thought I could make a difference. And three, tomorrow, I always feel in the end, the upside is huge, the downside is quite limited. I mean, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work, but you go out and try something. I mean, you know, what advice would you give to family and friends in that situation? The advice I would say is go and do something. Go and have some fun, go and enjoy it. And if it doesn't work, guess what? You'll still be able to feed yourself on a Friday night, so it's okay, you know? It's okay.
Absolutely. And I know that I've got a sort of bad tendency to try and convince people to leave their jobs and start companies based on the fact of like, what is the worst that could happen? And actually, it is a very sort of freeing feeling that. But so tell us more about the proposition of Sephora Marketing.
Well, I just felt that I'd done a lot in marketing. I've read a lot. I've sort of been fortunate enough to work with super companies and also be taught by the sort of the Ritzens of this world and Byron Sharp and all these kind of incredible people. And what I wanted to do was sort of set up a business that said, look, if you're a sort of small to medium-sized business, I'm not talking about Unilever or a P&G who, you know, have sophisticated marketing departments, and you've sort of reached a point where you feel that marketing, you want to do marketing, but you don't really know where to start and you don't really understand it, that someone like me could come in and either structure the department properly, set everyone else up for success, which is fine, and put a little bit of sort of framework in there. Or equally, if companies have teams, and I'm working with different companies, and one company I work with, you know, they have a quite established team, but perhaps they could do with a little bit of more experience, someone coming in, looking from the outside and saying, actually, sort of, why are we doing it like this? And, you know, is there a different way? And then I think the third bit is also the sort of training element, where to my earlier point about when I joined Santander, I wasn't trained in marketing. You know, I'd done a bit of it at university. And if I can come in and actually talk about stuff that people hadn't thought about, like segmentation, like targeting, like clear positioning, etc., that this could really sort of benefit people. So there's various different aspects to it. And then I also do a bit of teaching at Cambridge, which I really enjoy, which is for obviously sort of much younger people who just want to learn about marketing in a more academic sense. So there's quite a lot going on. But again, for me, it's just about adding a lot of value, leaving people in better places, and saying, look, whether this lasts 2 months, 2 years, or 20 years, it doesn't really matter. I just want to make a difference. And hopefully that's what I'm doing.
I think that the sort of fractional CMO approach is really getting a lot of attention, and quite rightly so. I think it fits so well into the way that smaller companies are working now, that, you know, they need access to brilliant experts, but can't always afford full time. So it's a great model.
It's been good so far. It's been going sort of 6 months. And as you know, I think you always have that founder's insecurity of what's going to happen in X amount of time, but you've also got to learn to teach yourself to say, live in the present, do the best you can, and the future almost needs to be taken care of, but let's just make sure the present is being done correctly.
I think if only we all knew that when we were a lot younger, I think probably there'd be a lot less worrying going on, right? So going back even further, and thank you very much for taking us through your career journey there, but going back even further, pre-business degree, so and maybe even back as far as primary school, what were you like as a child?
Gosh, I had quite a, what I would call a sort of complex background. I mean, no more complex than anyone else, I hasten to add. And, you know, I'm a really lucky individual who was sort of, who's had a lot of privilege and a lot of good fortune. So I start off by saying that as context to anything else I then talk about. But I was the youngest of three. I have two brothers who are supremely intelligent and successful guys, and we're really close as a family now. But I was the youngest of three, probably relatively quiet. And there's been two or three sort of defining moments in my life. The first was when I was 12 and my mum and dad split up. And now it's actually it's more common than it was then. Let me phrase it like that. And it can, you know, when you're 12, I have a 12-year-old daughter, so I sort of look at her now and I think she's fantastic, but you're relatively oblivious to some parts of the sort of wider world. And so I was oblivious to any unhappiness. You know, for me, we were a family that were going to stay together forever. And, you know, I still remember mum and dad telling us they were splitting up and all this kind of stuff. And that had quite a profound impact on me. You know, I missed my dad quite a lot. He moved out. It then impacted me at school, because if you think that was the year that you go from primary school to secondary school, that's an enormous jump, right? You go from what for me was quite a cosseted primary school to now a big achieving secondary school. And I struggled a lot at school, which is odd because I now read endless books, listen to endless podcasts. I love the academic side, watch my documentaries, but at school I struggled. And the two things I think were pretty much related, that I had this turbulence going on at home. And I don't, you know, when I look, I remember sort of showing my wife when we got together, I said, oh, these were my school reports. And they were brutal, brutal in the way they talked about me as an individual, brutal about the way effectively at the age of 12 or 13, I was being written off. And I think if that's the sense you get as a child from a school, you carry that and you think, well, I'm probably not, the effects sort of from a sort of self-esteem point of view and how you sort of carry yourself. And the other challenge I had when I was at school was that in the first year when all this was going on, they said maybe it's a good idea if he repeats the year, which was fine. But I was born in October. So I was old from my original year, where I was pretty ancient. But
right.
I had to repeat the year. You had kids who were almost like 20 months younger than you were in the same class. It doesn't matter at our age now. But I think at school, that kind of thing does matter. And so anyway, I found school quite a turbulent experience. And the thing that probably helped me was that I was into sport and I was reasonably good at sport. And that, especially at a school that plays football and cricket, actually is quite an equalizer. But nevertheless, it really taught me about how quick we all are to judge. And, you know, I sort of look around, as I say, at my daughter's friends now, and you never know what's going on. Just a little bit more understanding, a little bit more compassion, a little bit more kindness, actually, I could have done with. And so therefore you probably look back and think, that's what I can now give back to the world. So it wasn't an easy childhood, because all that stuff was going on. Then I was struggling at school, and it was only really when I got to university that I probably found myself again, and I could sort of thrive academically and work hard and enjoy it and be a different person. And so school was challenging, just generally speaking. But I think, as I say, I was a sensitive boy, and suddenly my world was a very different place one day after another. And then the other thing that changed my perspective was on life generally, was that in 2005, when I found myself unwittingly in the London bombings, if you can cast your mind back.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That far, that I was in the carriage where the bomb blew off at King's Cross.
Oh, wow.
So that was, and like I was sort of taken to hospital and in hospital for a few weeks and operated on and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I go back to what I said at the beginning, right? That I've had this incredibly privileged life with enormous opportunity, etc. So I don't say this for any kind of, oh my God, you know, look how difficult my life has been. It's been no more difficult, I'm sure, than anybody else's. But I use it as a learning experience just to say that, you know, life can change very, very quickly. For reasons entirely out of your control, evidently in something like that. And, you know, physically it can change, and, you know, people who you were standing 5 foot away from and their lives are totally changed and all this kind of stuff. One thing I have learned is just maybe just take one day at a time, 1 month at a time, 1 year at a time. Don't worry too much about the future. Let things just happen, and generally speaking, it will all be all right. So I think you try and take those two experiences, one from school, one from later in life, just to take a little bit of learning, and you then bring that into your work life, where, I don't know, I tend not to get too stressed by too much stuff, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I think in the end, it will all be okay.
Yeah, and it's interesting hearing you talk about school and other than the sport, that it wasn't the best experience, that you then went on to university. The temptation might have been just to stay away from academia altogether.
I've missed out a bit, actually, which might answer that question, which was that initially I thought, I'm not going to go to university, because to your point, I wasn't that into it. And so I spent 9 months in a warehouse in East London counting jeans that were coming in. That it was a jean retailer, and my job was, delivery would arrive, and say there were 800 jeans in this box, and I'd have to count these jeans, and I'd go up and I'd say, okay, there's 796, and the guy would look at the delivery note and go, no, there's not. Go and do that again. So you go, oh, God, really? So you sort of went back and you'd count these jeans. It says 800, and you say, yeah, now move on to the next box, and then the next box, and the next box. So that year, you then have a decision to make. Is this going to be what you do? Or are you going to try, if you can, to sort yourself out, go back to university, work hard, And I went to Brunel University, which is a decent university in London. Worked, in my mind, a bit stupidly hard. So I got first when I think only two people in the whole year did. It was quite a big thing.
Wow, congratulations.
No, thank you. But if I could give advice to myself, I would go back and say, go and enjoy it. Go out, go drinking, go and do what everyone else is doing. Go to Magaluf in the summer rather than, I don't know, extra lessons or something, right? Everything comes with a downside. So it was good, but I probably went from one extreme to the other. But I think that experience of counting jeans in a boiling hot warehouse in Walthamstow probably traumatised me enough to get me to university. And
getting you to uni. It's amazing how it works out. I mean, maybe it's just as well it wasn't a slightly better job. You know what I mean? If it's something, your life could have been in a very different place now. So coming back to the theme of the podcast, the genuine humans, who are the people who have, you know, given you that bit of extra support or who have influenced you, whether from your childhood or right up to Safira, you know, who are the people who've given you that support along the way?
Yeah, it's a good question. And there's so many in so many different ways. And it doesn't have to be, I find, people that you work with or work. It can just be people you meet for an X amount of period in your life where you just think,
yeah,
you know, you made a really sort of big impact on me. So there was my first teacher, Miss Colgate, great name, who could possibly forget a name like that, but she was at primary school. You know, she used to say to me, always go into things with a degree of enthusiasm. Don't lose the enthusiasm. And it's amazing. That was probably said to me 40 years ago, and yet you still remember it now. And I always say to my kids, do things, either do them, if you're going to do them, do it properly, right? Throw yourself into it and enjoy it. And then they're sort of lecturers at university who go a bit above and beyond. But then you go into the sort of workplace and there's people who, yeah, I remember someone sort of saying to me just about work, about in the end you just do the best you can, and either that's good enough or it's not, but the rest of it, of how you're judged on that, may well be out of your hands. There might be other reasons, so you sort of remember that. And then more recently, hanging around with people like Tamara, and, you know, I mean, I can probably name five or six people from that sort of group of folks who have all given me immense amount of time. They've all sort of said, yeah, you know, but to tomorrow's question, when you set it up, you actually sort of ring people up who you barely know, who you may have met a week before, and say, is there any way I could sort of spend an hour with you? And they have absolutely no obligation to say yes to this. But almost without exception, everyone's saying, yes, absolutely. And they all give you sort of words of wisdom, and probably because I think a lot of people say, well, people help me in this way. So I think as you get a little bit older and you get a little bit more sort of experience, then you just learn from so many people. And that might be watching a film and you just feel a documentary and you think, God, that's an interesting way to handle it. Or it might be reading a book, or it might be meeting people. But a lot of the people who I try and learn from, or I tend to learn from, they're very everyday people, you know. I mean, it's easy to sit there and say, Nelson Mandela, right? Well, of course. But actually, yeah, you can probably find inspiration from someone a lot closer to home doing something in a far more mundane world. If you've ever been into, you know, my wife's a doctor in the NHS. Well, spend a day working in the NHS and spend a day looking at what nurses have to do and what doctors have to do and the conversations they have to have and the way they go above and beyond. It wasn't that long ago we were clapping outside on was it Tuesday night or a Thursday night, whenever it was. And these people continue to do what they do. And I think there's inspiration all around if you just take a bit of time to look at it.
I love that. Thinking about how you sort of have transitioned from working like for really big companies and you know, sort of some slightly smaller ones, but they're still sort of like large companies. What sort of strategic difference have you noticed now that you sort of transitioned to running your own company?
What's quite interesting is that what I noticed in the sort of bigger companies, and I alluded to this before, is that you do a role and everyone can be a little bit protective of their own space. And so therefore getting involved in different things can be misinterpreted as people saying, no, this is what I do, that's what you do, never the two shall meet. One thing I've noticed about the role that I'm in now is that some people, I don't really do anything particularly tactical. You know, I'm not sitting there trying to work out where we should advertise. You know, should it be in the Daily Mirror or the Sun, for argument's sake? I'm not involved in those conversations. For me, it's about setting it up, looking at the strategy of the business, where are we going, looking at the product, looking at our pricing strategy, looking at our customer experience, looking at the market, who should we be targeting, where do we play, how do we win, what makes us different, what are competitors doing? And I think it's quite interesting because I think that, for me, is marketing. For me, is that, yeah. That's, I find them far more interesting side than shall we be on this platform or that platform. I think that's the end. That's the end of it, right? That's the end. That's the end game. But you know, if you look at it from the iceberg, cliche, I guess, what I'm doing at the moment is all the stuff below the iceberg. So one of the clients I'm working for, it's a total look at what our proposition is, what our culture is internally, how does that tie up to the brand, what new markets should we be going into. If this doesn't excite you, I don't think you should be doing marketing. I think this is the most exciting, this is real changing stuff for the next 10 years of that business or 15 years. And I don't think, I say this to her, maybe I'm wrong, right, and please challenge back, I don't think there's many roles in the corporate world where you have that scope, or maybe I'd still have got there. Maybe a bit of both. But I never really found that I could run things from cradle to grave like I am at the moment for these businesses, and also have really honest conversations and say, that's not going to work, right? And I think in a corporate world, I think the challenge I had was to tend to try and be honest, and I think that can come across sometimes as that's not the answer people want to hear. Whereas I find doing it now, because I'm from the outside, there's I have no vested interest in this other than telling the truth and being honest. Right, I mean, my career's not going to be here in 5 years' time. So I like the fact I feel like I get listened to a little bit more without people thinking, oh, you know, he needs to, because our CEO wants to do it, that's how it has to be done. Well, maybe we can have a conversation about that. And maybe I'm wrong, incidentally. I'm just giving an alternative point of view to make people think. That's all I'm trying to do.
Yeah, I think it's that outside in. I think people do want to be challenged, as you say. And it sounds like it's a real sort of driving force for you as well. You mentioned earlier about being sort of slightly quieter, and I know that you and I have had conversations about introversion and whether it's ambivert or extroverted introvert. One of the things that we've chatted about is that it's not always easy running your own business when you're expected to perhaps be more on the extrovert scale, putting yourself out there, sort of doing more, speaking to more people. Have you got any advice for someone who is a bit more introverted around starting your own agency or company?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think you and I have had chats about it. We've got more to come. But I think, look, in the end, you've got to force yourself to do stuff that maybe you don't feel comfortable doing. And I think that's quite a blunt way of doing it. And I'm someone who, honestly, you know, is very introverted. I get my energy from being on my own, right? Once I've had a day at work, I'm very happy to spend the next 3 hours reading my book and doing my own thoughts or going for a walk with the dog or whatever. But the reality is that when you're running your own company, is that no one is saying, oh, thank God Richard Levy is in the world. This is the company we've been waiting for. If only we knew, right, that this was coming, all our problems would be solved. I have to go out and I have to talk to people and understand and network, because also classically it may be tomorrow that we're having a conversation, but you're not in the market now, but you will be in 6 months' time, and we have to keep that relationship going. So the only advice I can give is, you know, the cliche, feel the fear and do it anyway. And you've just got to do it. And actually, if you're socially good and you can maintain a bit of eye contact and you can talk to people, a lot of people like talking about themselves, right? So actually, you can always start the conversation asking about the other person and then warm up to it. The other thing I did do that was interesting to help me, and it has helped me, was I joined an impro class.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which is really not me, I promise you, right? So suddenly you walk in and there's a bunch of strangers ranging from 20 to about 65, right? It's got the whole age group. And you end up sort of performing on stage in London in front of, I don't know, 200 odd people, whatever. I mean, they're all friends and family, so everyone wants you to succeed. But I'm now about, actually on Saturday, to start level 3. I think there's 7 levels, so I'm on level 3. Now, that's about pushing yourself a little bit out of your comfort zone, going to it. So go back to my talk you said right at the beginning. What's the worst that could happen? If it's awful after week one, don't go back. No one's going to think much of you. And you may enjoy it. That has taught me about listening, the importance of participation of everybody, bringing people in, total teamwork. So all these skills that actually are really, really essential to running your own business, actually that 8-week course on a Saturday morning has been quite essential for me. I'm not suggesting that it will be everyone's cup of tea, but there must be things people can do to help them overcome the barriers they'll find. And none of it is going to be in your comfort zone, but try something, right? And if it doesn't work, it's okay. Yeah. Don't go back the next time, right?
Brilliant. I didn't expect to hear that today. Improv classes. Sounds quite fun. So we're going to move on to the final section of the podcast now, where we get a bit more sort of quick fire personal questions. So we've got improv classes and reading and spending time on your own. What else would fill your perfect weekend?
Oh, a perfect weekend would be with the sun shining in the Lake District, walking around Oldswater or something like that. Maybe with a couple of other people where we're just sort of meandering around. In fact, I've just come back from Southwest Wales, Pembrokeshire. That's pretty cool as well, right? If you know that part of the world, but somewhere beautiful, where there's a little bit, it is beautiful. Right? It's just natural beauty. For someone who lives in London and coming out of that, is quite beautiful. So if you can transport me to the Lake District this weekend, I'd be pretty grateful.
Done.
Deal. We'll all go.
Yeah. So if you were walking on stage and your intro track is playing, what is it?
Goodness me, it's going to have to be something from my childhood. Dire Straits, Brothers in Arms, right? Loved that song.
Such a good album.
It's brilliant. I love Dire Straits. As I've got older, I appreciate the guitar playing, the singing. Yeah, it's got to be Brothers in Arms, right? It's fab.
Someone at my other half's work had tickets for a Dire Straits tribute band and they couldn't go. So we came home with them and I'm okay. And we had the most fabulous. I was the youngest person there, which probably helps. So it seemed like it. But yeah, really good choice.
Next time I'll go with you. Okay, we'll do a deal. We'll go to Dire Straits. Okay, sold.
So Richard, what are you doing when you feel most alive?
Ah, that's a good question. Probably, as I talked about my improv before, I've really enjoyed that. But probably going to things like the theatre, love doing that. Going to a concert, love it. I find music is a great connector. So most alive, definitely going to an event where there's just people who are supremely talented playing. I didn't get Oasis tickets though, so I won't be Wembley.
Me neither.
but most alive is definitely where there's a little bit of a vibe, something's happening, and you can just listen to a little bit of, whether it's the theatre or the cinema or a concert, something like that, you can get really into.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. How would you fare in a zombie apocalypse?
Not very well, I think would be the honest answer. I wouldn't want to be next to me. I don't know. On the one hand, I might keep calm. Right? I'd probably keep calm and thoughtful, but I'd probably try to analyse it. And everyone would be like, look, this isn't the time for your analysis, right?
Just run.
Just start thinking about it and move, right? So on that basis, probably pretty badly, I would suggest, right? I'd probably be left behind trying to work it all out. And I'd be like, no, it's too late now. You're dead. It's like, okay, sorry.
How would your friends describe you?
I asked them because you have to. And I said, you have to be honest, right? And most of it was pretty positive. Look, I think empathetic. I try and really understand people. We talked about the reasons why that's the case. I'm a real family person, right? I mean, I think the family is ultimately everything. And everything I do is for them and for vice versa. So empathetic, family. But there's a little bit of a dry humour there, and I try and sort of I try and have fun, because actually, and I say this a lot to people, life is great. Life is great, right? I mean, it is, right? In my view, life is the best thing around, and there's going to be ups and downs, but try and enjoy it, and try and enjoy yourself, right? And try and enjoy yourself in whatever form that may be. That might be being and reading a book, or it might be going out with 100 people. But we're not here forever, sadly, right? So I think they would describe me as someone who actually wants to wants to enjoy stuff.
Great. Okay, if you could time travel to any point, past or future, with no consequences, where and when would you travel to?
I would go back to the day that Neil Armstrong landed on the moon, because I gather it was a rather phenomenal global event that when you actually look up at the moon now and you think, wow, we actually, you know, put people up there, they wandered around, they planted their flag. That's pretty incredible from a sort of humanity point of view. So if I could probably go back to any time, it would be to see that. But if I might slightly cheat and say, I'm always fascinated by history. My mother was a historian. And when you wander around places like Pompeii and Pompeii, and you go to these places, and we go to Rome and you see the Colosseum, and you think, it might be quite good fun to have watched how that was being built X amount of 1,000 years ago, or how these villages in the Roman times survived, you know, just thrived. I think that'd be a pretty cool time to live. Not if you spoke out, though, I think. You'd have to be compliant, right? And we might struggle with that.
You'd be okay, because you'd just be booted back to the present.
Oh, yeah, okay,
no,
fine.
No consequences.
Yeah. Although, wouldn't it be cool to be able to say to the conspiracy theorists, no, we did what we did.
Walk on the beach. Yeah. You and I.
Richard, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This has been so, so good to get to know you more, to understand your background. Is there anything that we didn't ask, or have you got any closing thoughts that you'd like to share?
No, not at all, really. I mean, just to say thank you to both of you for the time. And, you know, a million thanks to, when I talk about my life and career and everything, I have so many people and so many things to be thankful for. And I think the last sort of 45 minutes or so made me really think about that as well. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to do so.
You've been listening to Genuine Humans, brought to you by Social Element. If you loved what you heard, remember to rate, review, and subscribe.